Wondery Plus subscribers can binge new seasons of American Scandal early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
This episode contains some strong language. It's early morning, Monday, July 2nd, 2007. Joe Bruno should be prepping for the annual hometown July 4th parade and stockpiling hot dogs for the barbecue at his farm. Instead, he's fuming. On Sunday, the Albany Times-Union broke a story that he used state aircraft for political fundraisers and personal trips. It also made mention of the FBI investigation that's been dogging Bruno for the last year. It's no wonder he spent the early morning hours pacing the office. And he knows exactly who's behind it. The leak has the fingerprints of Elliot Spitzer's office all over it. He picks up the phone to call his top spokesman, John McCardle, hoping he's made some headway with the press.
Senator Bruno.
John, did you talk to the Times?
In the paper this morning, page B23. I made it clear this thing was politically motivated, and there's nothing to look at here. All of those trips were business.
Spitzer has taken more personal trips on his political crusade against me in a month. If that's not personal, what is? Did you mention that I need troopers because of the death threats I get?
Yeah, it's in there. Listen, they mentioned the FBI thing again.
What does it say?
Federal investigators have been scrutinizing his outside business activities and have issued subpoenas to a number of businesses that have received state aid at his direction.
Jesus. Anything else?
Well, they're calling for an investigation into the flights.
Who is?
Spitzer's office, Dopp.
You gotta be kidding me. We've got to get in front of this, John.
I know, Senator. You've got a press conference at noon.
I'm calling Stone.
Senator Bruno may be almost 80 years old, but he's just as shrewd as the day he took office. He's kept his seat in office for more than 30 years because he knows how to bob and weave. He just needs to get off the ropes and start making some jabs. And with a little help, he'll be back on top in no time. Spitzer has no idea what's about to hit him.
American Scandal is sponsored by Audible. I get the thrill of, say, skydiving, but it's a lot of work and expense for something that lasts only minutes and comes with some safety concerns. Instead, I get my thrills in a lower dose, stretched out over hours with a good mystery. Like in the Penguin modern classic Perfume, The Story of a Murderer by Patrick Susskind. And as an Audible member, I can choose one title every month to keep forever from the entire catalog of classics, bestsellers, new releases, and Audible originals ready to listen whenever, wherever on the Audible app. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/AS or text AS to 500-500. That's audible.com/AS or text AS to 500-500. American Scandal is sponsored by True Green. This is a true story. Right now, fertilizer is spilled all over my garage, and the fertilizer spreader has lost a wheel. While I'm usually pretty DIY, some things I leave to professionals. True Green is the easiest and most affordable way to a beautiful lawn. You water and mow, they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. You can trust True Green to give you the best lawn because they are the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. They offer a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. So you do you and let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people, guaranteed.
From Wondery, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is American Scandal. This is the second episode in our series about Albany, New York. In our last episode, Elliot Spitzer, the heroic sheriff of Wall Street, was elected governor on the promise to clean up the cesspool of Albany politics. But 6 months later, Governor Spitzer is at war with his chief rival, Senate Majority Leader Joe Bruno, one of the most powerful men in the state. It's a war that's about to get a whole lot worse. This is episode 2, An Affair to Remember. The party at Senator Bruno's upstate farm on July 4th has often been a festive affair. But for Joe Bruno, the holiday's always a mixed bag. He loves the local parades and the high fives and handshakes from the people in the county who love him because he's gotten them baseball stadiums, parks, and playgrounds, some with his name on them. But his thoroughbreds are always spooked by the fireworks. Tonight, he's just as jumpy, after a conversation with Fred Dicker from The Post. Bruno's finally on the attack. If Dicker reports this right, come tomorrow morning, he might just get the upper hand on this whole travel fiasco. It's been a tough few weeks. Last month, the Times Union obtained a grand jury subpoena to look into the specifics of an ongoing FBI investigation around Bruno's outside business interests with substantial and important business people, as Bruno's firm calls their clients. It turns out the feds are particularly interested in Bruno's close relationship with Jared Abruzzese, a wealthy businessman who's been lobbying to run the state's multi-billion-dollar horse racing franchise. Abruzzese has arranged fundraisers for Bruno, taken him on vacation in his private jet, and paid him nearly $500,000 in so-called consulting fees. They are also looking into something less colorful but equally as lucrative, Bruno's employment with Wright Investment Services. The firm is paying Bruno a large consulting fee for referring clients to Wright. And now, this thing about misusing state aircraft is front and center, an ethics charge that could throw him out of office. Bruno is certain this is Spitzer's endgame, but Bruno has a weapon that Spitzer does not. Roger Stone. Stone is an icon of American politics. He made his reputation back in the 70s as Richard Nixon's dirty trickster, and he's proud of it. He sports a giant tattoo of Nixon's face on his back. He leads a colorful personal life, often visiting swingers clubs with his wife. On Stone's resume is a who's who of American politics: Ronald Reagan, Bob Dole, George Bush. He has two mottos that have served him well over the years: attack, 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 never defend. And admit nothing, deny everything, launch counterattack. So in June, when Bruno has had enough of Spitzer and his attacks on the Republican majority, he turned to Roger Stone. Stone is a master at manipulating the press. He and his team collect negative stories on Spitzer and feed a steady drip to journalists trying to paint him as an angry thug and a spoiled elitist brat. Stone's fee is $20,000 a month. The money helps support Stone's expensive habits. He collects Jaguars and fancy clothes. There are more than 100 custom-made suits in his closet, but there's no denying it. The dirty trickster gets results. So far, Joe Bruno does not regret paying Stone's bill. On Thursday, July 5th, at 6 a.m., Elliot Spitzer is returning to the governor's mansion from an early morning jog. He walks into the kitchen, grabs the paper. He knows the New York Post's Fred Dickers is publishing something, and it won't be flattering. But what's on the front page stops him in his tracks. The headline reads, "Gov's Trooper Snoop on Bruno." He drops into the nearest chair and picks up a phone. He's not happy.
Mr. Governor.
Dop, you seeing this?
I'm looking at it right now, Governor.
It says Governor Spitzer targeted State Senate Majority Leader Joseph Bruno for an unprecedented state police surveillance program?
It's a total spin job, Governor.
They're saying I directed state troopers to spy on Bruno, that I singled him out.
I told Dicker the police started keeping records when Mike Long, from his own party, for Christ's sakes, complained about Bruno bringing armed troopers to his fundraiser.
But Long denies it. Look at Bruno's quote. He says, "This is like something you'd expect in a third world country, where some dictator has his enemies followed to see how they could either do something to them or disgrace them. This is dangerous in a free country."
Bruno just loves to play the victim. You know that. It'll blow over, Governor. A few days, a week, tops.
Except that it doesn't blow over. In a television interview later that day, Bruno calls Spitzer a bully and a hypocrite, and his aides hoodlums and thugs. The next day, Bruno calls for a criminal probe into Spitzer's tactics. Admit nothing, deny everything, launch counterattack. The media quickly dubs the affair Troopergate. The question is no longer whether Bruno's been flying state aircraft to $5,000 a plate fundraising dinners. Now, it's how dangerous and conniving is Elliot Spitzer. In a 1-2 punch, Bruno has just turned the tables. Attorney General Andrew Cuomo has been very vocal about his desire to one day be governor. And what better place to pave the way than the Attorney General's office? It worked for Spitzer. Now Cuomo has the opportunity of a lifetime. He's been called on to investigate corruption in Albany by two of the most powerful men in the state. He'll need to tread lightly so there's no blowback on his office. He and his team get to work, requesting emails and records and conducting interviews. 3 weeks later, on July 23rd, Cuomo issues his report. It's long, and it's scathing. The investigators find there was an orchestrated campaign by the governor's office to obtain and provide information to the news media with the help of the state police to essentially discredit Joe Bruno. It says the governor's staff ordered the state police to keep special records of Bruno's whereabouts when he traveled with police escorts in New York City, and to create records from memory if they didn't exist. It concludes by saying while Spitzer's office had broken no laws, and there was no spying as Bruno contended, there was a clear breach of ethics. Cuomo places the blame at the feet of three of Spitzer's staff. The governor, for now, is deemed innocent. The report also clears Bruno of misusing the state's air fleet, though it calls the state's policy porous and recommends tightening it up. For the governor who sailed into office promising ethics reform, this doesn't look good. On the morning of July 23rd, Governor Spitzer and his team gather in his office at the Capitol and reread the report before it's officially released by Cuomo's office. Then, with a sigh, he leans back in his chair, girds himself. He's about to do something he's rarely done in his life, eat crow. He picks up the phone and dials Joseph Bruno.
What can I do for you, Governor?
Joe, I owe you an apology. I had no idea what Darren Dopp was up to, what my office was up to. I know it caused you a hell of a lot of problems, and I'm sorry for that.
Well, that's mighty magnanimous of you, Governor.
Joe.
Jesus, Elliot. You've had the state troopers on my heels following me while you're fucking around with the press, painting me as a bad actor? You are a hypocrite. You think I don't know why you're calling? I know exactly why. So you can tell the press you said sorry.
All right, Joe. I tried. You have my apology. Please accept it.
I appreciate your call, Governor.
For Bruno, it's a case of too little, too late. Elliot Spitzer puts down the phone. He's tried to do the right thing. Now he has to do one more unpleasant thing. Put Communications Director Darren Dopp on indefinite, unpaid leave. Whether Dopp acted on his own or whether Spitzer told him to leak Bruno's travel details doesn't matter. It will look better to the people of New York for someone to go down. Then, eat more crow at a press conference in the Red Room, where he tells the crowd of reporters that he is accountable for what goes on in the executive branch, and he accepts responsibility for the actions of his office. He says his administration has grossly mishandled this situation. He tells them he apologized to Senator Bruno personally this morning. It's been a very bad day. Even the New York Times jumps in with an editorial saying the episode has the smell of an old-fashioned dirty trick. And if Spitzer fails to clean up his own house, his ability to clean up Albany could be severely compromised. 4 days later, on July 27th, State Senator Dean Skelos pushes the issue further. Skelos grew up in Rockville Center, New York, in a family of Greek descent. Apart from college, he never left his small town. An attorney who still practices on the side. He's been at the legislature for more than a quarter century. He knows how to win influence. In one of his earliest elections, he persuaded Ronald Reagan to stump for him. Skelos is also practiced in the ways Albany works and perfectly happy with the culture of trading favors. He's also widely known as Bruno's attack dog. Skelos pulls no punches maligning Spitzer. He recommends his Committee on Investigations and Government Operations review Trooper Gate. He says, we have the real makings of a conspiracy here. Spitzer tries to shift the press's attention back to the actual work of the governor's office, but the bad press keeps on coming, for weeks. Roger Stone helps fan the flames. Attack, attack, never defend. But Stone's dogged enthusiasm to take down Spitzer is about to take a poisonous and baffling turn. As the summer wears on, the heat in New York grows more stifling. People are on edge, and the crime rates are up. At 10 p.m. on August 6th, A phone rings in an empty office on the 22nd floor of the Crown Building on Fifth Avenue. No one is there. The owner, 83-year-old Bernard Spitzer, the governor's multimillionaire father, left work early that day to go home and rest. He suffers from Parkinson's and tires easily these days. The machine in his office picks up, and the caller leaves a message.
This is a message for Bernard Spitzer. You will be subpoenaed to testify before the Senate Committee on Investigations on your shady campaign loans. You will be compelled by the Senate Sergeant-at-Arms. If you resist the subpoena, you will be arrested and brought to Albany. And there's not a goddamn thing your phony, psycho, piece-of-shit son can do about it.
The voicemail is referring to questions around how Elliot Spitzer financed his 1994 run for attorney general. Questions that have never been put to rest, mostly because Republicans are keeping them alive. A private investigator traces the callback to a phone belonging to the wife of political consultant Roger Stone. Stone denies it, saying he was at the theater that night, watching a Broadway show called Frost Nixon. But there was no such performance. Then, Stone tries to pin it implausibly, both on the Democratic owner of his apartment building and on Spitzer himself. But on August 22, 2007, investigations conclude that Stone left the message. For the last month, Bruno had been enjoying his status as an elder statesman wronged by a dirty dealing governor. So this is embarrassing. Stone is on his payroll. Stone has made him look anything but statesmanlike. Bruno forces Roger Stone to resign. In November 2007, not even a year into office, Elliot Spitzer has been plagued by scandal. There are now 10 separate ongoing Troopergate investigations. Soon, there will be investigations of the investigations. When the dust clears, millions will be spent and no one will be found guilty of anything. But for Spitzer, it's beginning to look like Troopergate will take over his legacy. Voters are disillusioned. Spitzer came into office with nearly 70% of the vote, but a recent poll shows only 25% would elect him again. He is determined to crawl out from underneath this dark cloud and earn New Yorkers' trust again. What Governor Spitzer does not know is he will soon be looking back at Troopergate as the good old days. Another scandal is coming, something much worse.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Long before becoming governor, Elliot Spitzer was an assistant district attorney in Manhattan, where he played a pivotal role in prosecuting the Gambino crime family. He came up with an ingenious idea for a sting operation, a phony garment sweatshop. The Gambinos were known to extort money from businesses in the garment district, and Spitzer was betting that sooner or later, they would come to his phony shop and demand their cut too. It was a gamble, but it paid off. Thanks to Elliot Spitzer, the Manhattan DA's office took down one of the most notorious mob families in the country. Spitzer used his success in the district attorney's office to run for attorney general, and won. As Attorney General, he focused on Wall Street, investment banks and bankers who he believed were every bit as corrupt as the mob, just with better suits. During his 8 years in that role, Spitzer went after institutions previously thought to be unassailable. Merrill Lynch, Bank of America, AIG. He not only prosecuted top-level investment bankers, he got convictions. It earned him the moniker, the Sheriff of Wall Street. Spitzer's success in exposing financial fraud did not just earn him a nickname, it also earned him some very rich and very powerful enemies. Since becoming the governor of New York, that enemies list has only gotten longer. He just doesn't know how long. But in February 2008, Spitzer is feeling confident. Troopergate is mostly behind him. He's had a few legislative wins, and his poll numbers are slowly ticking up. Now he's on his way to Washington at the request of Congress to testify and share some of his financial expertise. Late in the afternoon, the governor checks into room 871 of the elegant Mayflower Hotel, also known as the Hotel of Presidents. After settling in, he calls room service, orders a scotch, and gets in the shower. A few minutes later, the phone rings. It's the front desk asking to speak to Mr. Fox. Elliot Spitzer has checked in under a pseudonym, George Fox, which also happens to be the name of one of his good friends and a major donor to the New York Democratic Party. The clerk says there's a woman named Kristen to see him. Moments later, there's a knock. Elliot Spitzer, governor of New York, a.k.a. George Fox, wearing the plush hotel bathrobe, opens the door to find a beautiful 22-year-old woman named Kristen standing in the hallway. Kristen is also a pseudonym. Actually, it's her second pseudonym. Her first is Ashley Dupre, the name she uses while pursuing her singing career. Kristen is her call girl name. She thinks Mr. Fox looks familiar, although she can't quite place him. Ashley, a.k.a. Kristen, is from New Jersey, and she doesn't even follow the news from her home state, so New York politics is about as far from her awareness as the moon. Mr. Fox, a.k.a. Elliot Spitzer, quickly ushers her in. What happens next is anyone's guess, but when a nearly 50-year-old married man, who happens to be the governor of New York, and a beautiful 22-year-old call girl from New Jersey secretly meet in an expensive Washington, D.C. hotel room, it usually isn't to discuss politics. A little over 2 hours later, Kristen leaves with $4,300 in cash, $2,600 for her and $1,700 as a deposit for future services with the Emperor's Club, the exclusive Manhattan escort agency Mr. Fox has used to set up this tryst. The next morning, it's business as usual for Governor Spitzer. He goes to Capitol Hill for a full day of meetings and then returns home to his wife and family in Albany to fight duplicity and deception in the state capitol. If he feels any sense of irony, he isn't letting on. But the affair is not a secret. Someone has been watching. Elliot Spitzer is under surveillance. Not by the New York State Police, but by the feds. The federal government became interested in Governor Spitzer in the summer of 2006 after his bank noticed unusual wire transfers and reported it to the IRS. After some digging, the IRS learned the money was going to shell companies associated with the Emperor's Club. The IRS then alerted the federal authorities. Why the feds are suddenly interested in a Manhattan call girl operation is a puzzle. Standard protocol is to hand off an investigation into a prostitution ring to city or state law enforcement, but they don't. Instead, they proceed to wiretap and surveil the governor starting in January. Eventually, they pass their findings onto the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York. As a branch of the U.S. Justice Department, the Southern District of New York is tasked with prosecuting federal crimes, but hiring a prostitute is not a federal crime. So an investigation like this is highly unusual. Soon, the feds are not only able to confirm Spitzer's recent tryst at the Mayflower Hotel with Kristen, but also that he has been a client of the Emperor's Club for some time. On Friday, March 7th, the New York Times reports that federal authorities have arrested four people for running a web-based prostitution ring, which has been servicing clients in Miami, New York, and D.C. That evening, Spitzer receives a tip from a Times reporter. The feds have identified him as Client 9 of the Emperor's Club. The reporter tells him that the Times intends to print the story on Monday. But how did the reporter get Spitzer's name? No one knows. Spitzer's list of enemies was almost as long as Manhattan, but someone did leak it, and Spitzer's was the only name the feds identified that made it to the press. Someone wanted the governor gone. On Saturday, March 8th, the governor puts on his game face and, along with Mrs. Spitzer, travels back to D.C. for the Gridiron Club dinner, an annual white tie event attended by Washington elites. The governor manages to engage and mingle, but his mind is elsewhere. Back in New York City, his world is on the verge of collapse, and his family, his reputation, and his entire life's work look like they will be buried in the rubble. On Sunday, March 9th, the Spitzers return to New York, and the governor starts to panic. Late that night, he sends his senior advisor, who is also a lawyer, several frantic emails asking if he can talk. When they finally get on the phone at midnight, Spitzer tells him the Times is going to report that he has been involved with prostitutes. "As of now, you are my counsel," he says, then sits down with his wife, Silda, and his daughters to have the most heart-wrenching talk of his life. On Monday morning, March 10th, the governor cancels an 11 a.m. speech he is scheduled to give to the Family Planning Advocates of New York. Aides tell the press the governor is ill. Others say that there's been a scheduling conflict. Neither is true. The governor is simply in no condition to give a speech. The governor's offices in both Manhattan and Albany are in complete chaos. Although the story has still not broken, the governor instructs his senior aides to let staff in both offices know that the release of the story is imminent and that it's true. It's just after lunch. Lieutenant Governor David Patterson receives a call from one of the governor's top aides, Richard Baum. Baum is whispering from inside a bathroom in the governor's apartment.
"Lieutenant Governor."
"Richard, I can hardly hear you."
"Did you read the article in the Times?"
"I haven't, no. Which article?"
"The Emperor's Club prostitution ring. The governor's about to be indicted. I think he's going to resign. You may have to step in. Oh, God, I got to go."
As Patterson hangs up the phone, he's sure he misheard Baum. He calls his aide to see what he knows.
"Lieutenant Governor."
"Hey, yeah, look, I just got off the phone with Baum. Do you know anything coming out of the governor's office today?"
"Why?"
"Look, it was a short phone call and I probably misheard him. I'm convinced it has nothing to do with him, but maybe one of the Spitzer companies or something."
"No, sir. I'm sorry to say you heard correctly. It's the governor."
"Oh, God. I'm not sure what I should be doing right now."
"Well, sir, I suggest you start putting some thoughts together and making some notes. We might use them for your inauguration speech."
By noon, the horrible news is sinking in for Governor Spitzer's staff in both Albany and New York. Some are in shock. Some are angry. Others are distraught, even crying. Many staffers left good jobs in the private sector to go work for a man and a cause they believed in. Other staff members are in denial. They refuse to believe this exemplar of law and order and devoted family man could ever be involved in something so unseemly. Then things take another turn. Richard Baum places another call to the lieutenant governor, telling him that the governor's resignation may not be imminent after all. For the next 2 hours, nobody on the governor's staff knows whether he's going to quit or fight. At approximately 2 p.m., the governor's office notifies staff and the press that an announcement will be made at 2:15, topic unknown. The New York Times catches wind of the scheduled announcement. To ensure they are not scooped by the governor, they drop the story on their website at 2:10 p.m. with a simple headline that will send shockwaves throughout the state and the entire country. It reads, "Spitzer is linked to prostitution ring." The governor's 2:15 announcement is postponed. His staff is in turmoil. Finally, at 3:25, Governor Spitzer appears at the podium with Mrs. Spitzer at his side. He looks haggard. The stress he's been under is etched on his face. Silda Spitzer is stoic, but there are tears in her eyes. Without citing any specifics, the governor makes a brief statement.
"Good afternoon. Today, I want to briefly address a private matter. I have acted in a way that violates my obligations to my family and that violates my or any sense of right and wrong. I apologize first and most importantly to my family. I apologize to the public, whom I promised better. I do not believe that politics in the long run is about individuals. It is about ideas, the public good, and doing what is best for the state of New York. But I have disappointed and failed to live up to the standard I expected of myself. I must now dedicate some time to regain the trust of my family. I will not be taking questions. Thank you very much. I will report back to you in short order. Thank you very much.
As Spitzer turns to leave, reporters call out, "Are you resigning?" But he and his family keep walking, headed for the seclusion of their Fifth Avenue apartment. Throughout the day, media reports indicate that the governor is planning to resign, but it can't be confirmed. The governor's office has no comment, saying only that the governor's schedule has been cleared for the day. Governor Spitzer has admitted to the public that he is guilty of wrongdoing, but he hasn't publicly confessed exactly what that might be. Now, he has a monumental decision to make. Some of his staff urge him to stay the course. Sure, it will be a bumpy ride, but with a public mea culpa and an announcement that he will seek treatment for sex addiction, there's a good chance it'll blow over. It's happened before. Ted Kennedy, Bill Clinton. Of course, neither of them came into office promising to reform corruption and ethics. But Spitzer is a fighter, and the time to fight is now. Others believe if he doesn't leave of his own accord, there is very good chance he will be impeached by both the Republicans in the Senate and the Democrats. For the first time, maybe ever, Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver claims he has no way of controlling how the Democrats in the House will vote. But it's the governor himself who must make the decision. Does he fight for a second chance to fulfill his campaign promises and fight corruption? Or is it too late?
When it comes to hiring, don't go searching for the one. Just meet your match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/match. Just go to Indeed.com/match right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/match. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
At 7 p.m. on Friday, March 7th, 2008, while Governor Spitzer contemplates whether to publicly apologize for his actions and wait out the bad press or simply resign, the Associated Press drops another bomb. The governor has spent an estimated $80,000 on escorts, not just as governor, but going back to his days as attorney general, when he was responsible for enforcing the laws of New York State. The press is now in a feeding frenzy. The New York Post gleefully assigns a new nickname to the governor. He's no longer the sheriff of Wall Street. He's the love gov. And within just a few hours, the scandal quickly gains national attention.
The New York Times is reporting New York Governor Eliot Spitzer has told his senior administration officials he had been involved in a prostitution ring.
In the country, the governor of New York, Eliot Spitzer, announced that he had been hiring young women from an escort service. And by the way, he's a former prosecutor.
Republicans waste no time pouncing. Minority Leader James Todisco, who Spitzer once threatened to steamroll, issues a statement saying, "The governor has disgraced his office and the entire state of New York. He is unfit to lead our state and unfit to hold public office." He follows it with a threat of his own. Unless the governor resigns in the next 48 hours, Todisco will call for articles of impeachment against him. It appears the choice has been made for Spitzer. On the morning of Wednesday, March 12th, 2008, only 14 and a half months into his term, Spitzer's office announces that the governor will make a brief statement to the press at 11:30 a.m. At 10:45 a.m., Spitzer's nemesis, Senate Majority Leader Joe Bruno, breaks his silence and makes a statement to the press that foreshadows Elliot Spitzer's inevitable demise.
We are going to partner with the lieutenant governor and when he becomes governor, to govern. And David has always been very open with me, very forthright, and I look forward to a positive, productive relationship soon as possible. Thank you all.
The press swarms outside the doors of Spitzer's Tony Fifth Avenue apartment as Governor and Mrs. Spitzer emerge and make their way into the back of a black SUV. Helicopters hover above as the car slowly makes its way to the governor's office. The street is lined with thousands of people, some with cameras, some with signs of support. A few look sad, others angry. Spitzer's senior advisor will later say it felt like a motorcade headed to a public execution. Silda Spitzer, an elegant and gracious woman, is still shell-shocked from the bomb dropped on her just a few days earlier. Having grown up in a Southern Baptist family in North Carolina, no one ever prepared her for such a humiliating situation. Bad enough if all this happened privately, but this... She doesn't have the luxury of worrying about herself right now. She has daughters at home and a role to play. As the caravan slows to a stop at his New York office, Spitzer apologizes to the state police escorts, and then again to his staff when he reaches the 39th floor. He implores them not to lose faith in government service because of his actions. And then, at 11:40 a.m., with Silda, his wife, by his side, Elliot Spitzer steps up to a podium.
In the past few days, I've begun to atone for my private failings with my wife, Silda, my children, and my entire family. I am deeply sorry that I did not live up to what was expected of me. Over the course of my public life, I have insisted, I believe correctly, that people, regardless of their position or power, take responsibility for their conduct. I can and will ask no less of myself. For this reason, I am resigning from the office of governor.
It's the last time Spitzer will speak publicly as governor. His resignation will take effect the following Monday. Once Governor Spitzer has been shown the door, only two of the three men in a room remain, and the press is eager to hear from Sheldon Silver and Joe Bruno. Silver releases a statement to the press that reads, in part, "This is obviously a painful day for all of New York. Now I think it is the time to pray for the Spitzer family, for his parents, for his wife, for his children. It is also the time to move forward with the people's business." Joe Bruno's statement is also politically correct. "I'm going to leave it to the governor and his family to sort out how they deal with the present circumstances and the future. And frankly, I have them in my prayers." Joe Bruno and his second-in-command, Dean Skelos, are sitting across from each other at a quiet restaurant. Bruno has spent years grooming Skelos to assume the role of majority leader when he retires. Bruno trusts him, as much as you can trust anyone in Albany. But now that Spitzer's out of the picture, Joe plans to stick around for a while.
"Let's have a toast, Dean, shall we? To justice."
"To justice."
"To quote Jackie Gleason, how sweet it is."
"Joe, I have to ask you, just between you and me, do you have any idea who..."
"Dean, the line of people who wanted to see Spitzer go down would stretch from Albany to Staten Island and back. The Spitzer problem has been neutralized. That's all that matters. As far as I'm concerned, he died of his own hubris."
"All right. Well, here's to Governor Patterson, and to you, the new lieutenant governor. How's it feel?"
"Oh, it fits like a glove."
With his arch nemesis out of the picture, Joe Bruno hopes all of his troubles are in the rearview mirror. And the next 5 months of the Patterson administration run pretty smoothly for both Silver and Bruno, with a new governor in place. But in December 2007, the New York Times prints an article about Joe Bruno's employment with Wright Investor Service. While Bruno has never denied referring clients their way, up until now, no one has known who the clients were. The article reveals that several of those clients are New York labor unions who have invested tens of millions of dollars in pension funds with Wright.
They also happen to be the single largest contributor to Bruno's campaign fund, giving hundreds of thousands of dollars annually. Bruno denies there is anything wrong with the arrangement, but Democrats, the press, and a few million New Yorkers don't see it that way. After a few weeks of intense pressure, Bruno announces he's severed his ties with Right Investors Service. Once again, a case of too little, too late, because in February 2008, the FBI subpoenas the financial records of the labor unions. They want to know what happened, exactly, and what role Joe Bruno played. The following month, a New York Magazine article interviews Bruno, who tells the reporter his role was to provide entree and access. The federal government has a name for what Joe Bruno was doing. It's called honest services fraud, depriving citizens of honest services as a public official by improperly mixing public and private work. It's a nice way to put it, but what it really means is that Bruno has been selling his favors to a high bidder rather than honestly serving the people of New York. No matter what you call it, it still smells rotten to the voters of New York. The press pounces, and Joe Bruno knows he has stepped in it this time. He issues denial after denial, claiming he never said anything to that New York Magazine reporter about providing access. And when that doesn't work, he claims that he was misquoted. Then he says maybe he did say it, but the reporter has betrayed his trust. He was speaking off the record. 2 months later, in May of 2008, the FBI starts a new investigation into the Legislative Ethics Committee, the body that approved Bruno's dealings with Wright and the unions. It's getting very hot, and Joe Bruno needs to get out of the kitchen. In June, after serving the Senate for 31 years, he resigns as majority leader and announces he will not run for re-election. He cites personal reasons, because that sounds better than I'm being investigated by the FBI and I may end up in prison soon. Joe Bruno spends the next several months denying he did anything illegal. But in January of 2009, the feds disagree, and the Southern District of New York indicts Joe Bruno on 8 counts of corruption. Prosecutors also charge Bruno with accepting over $1 million from 3 businessmen for providing entree, as Joe Bruno liked to say. One of the 3 businessmen, the regular GOP donor named Jared Abruzzese, paid Bruno $80,000 for a horse raised on Bruno's farm that was, according to prosecutors, ready for the glue factory and not worth a fraction of that. The Republicans circle the wagons and support their man, despite the overwhelming evidence pointing to his guilt. The new majority leader, Dean Skelos, says Joe Bruno is a fighter who has successfully confronted many tough challenges throughout his life, and I'm very confident he will continue to do so. In November of 2009, 80-year-old Joe Bruno's trial begins, and he brings his gloves to court. His behavior is defiant, some might even say entitled. At one point, he mutters aloud about a ruling he doesn't like, within earshot of the jury. That's a no-no, and the federal judge has no problem admonishing former Senator Bruno as he would a child. For once in your life, you don't control something. I do. You ever do what you just did in the presence of that jury again, which is question any of my rulings, I will take measures to make sure you don't repeat that. You understand me? Of the 8 counts, the jury acquits Bruno of 5 and hangs on a 6th, but he is convicted of 1 count of mail fraud and 1 count of wire fraud. Bruno is sentenced to 2 years in federal prison. But Bruno's a cat who lands on his feet, and his convictions are overturned when the U.S. Supreme Court narrows the definition of honest services fraud in 2010. A year later, at a retrial, Bruno is acquitted on all 8 accounts. The acquittal also allows him to file for repayment of all of his legal fees, $1.8 million. He returns to the tranquility of his sprawling horse farm upstate, where today, at almost 90, he still reads the Albany papers every day. After Spitzer's breathtaking fall from grace, followed by Joe Bruno's resignation from the Senate, 2 of the 3 men who occupied the room in 2007 and 2008 are gone. Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver is the last man standing, and the Senate has a new majority leader, Dean Skelos. But there's still a place in the room for a third man. Both Silver and Skelos are going to find that the new governor has no intention of keeping it business as usual in Albany.
from Wondery. This is episode 2 of 5 of New York State of Crime for American Scandal. On the next episode, a new York governor vows to take on corruption, while a new U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York starts his own investigation into crime at the Capitol that will take down 2 of the most powerful men in the state. This episode contains reenactments and dramatized details. And while in most cases we can't know exactly what was said, all our dramatizations are based on historical research. American Scandal is hosted, edited, sound designed, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham, for Airship. Additional production assistance by Derek Behrens. This episode is written by Michael Byrne. Our consultant is longtime Albany journalist Jay Jochnovitz. Executive producers are Stephanie Jens, Marshall Louie, and Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.